So anyway, my name is Michael McCusker. Today is what is known as VJ Day, Victory Over Japan, the day Japan surrendered 69 years ago in 1945, which ended World War II. Surrender ceremonies aboard the USS Missouri in Tokyo Harbor on September 2nd that year are in contention for the real VJ Day. Today's VJ Day is also the birthday of someone I have known and loved for nearly half a century, who was born that very same day. I wrote a poem about her. I call it Julie. The other VJ Day is the 69th birthday of Michael Horowitz, formerly of Portland and now of the Kingdom of Tonga, where he is president of the world's smallest university. Julie and VJ Day. You might have been named Victoria Jane. You knew a girl who was. Poor girl, you said. You are 69, VJ Day, the day you were born. The World War ended. Millions dead. Gone. Never more forever. You are new life, born amidst burial. A sad world you make warm. You unconditional mother. You wonderful woman. I love you always. And that's Julie and VJ Day. I originally wrote it on the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II, 8/14/1995. Now I'd like to read something that has something that pertains to the war, which in a sense was the advent of something else. I call it The Mushrooms of August, and I guess I better give my disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in all of the cosmos. And I start with a line or a quote from the wonderful Kate Wolfe. Now the sun has come to earth, shrouded in a mushroom cloud of death. And that was Kate Wolfe. The nuclear age began 69 years ago. The mushroom cloud was first seen in the clear sky over a desert. Quickly, it became the tombstone of two Japanese cities. Hiroshima was the first on August 6, 1945. Nagasaki was next, 3 days later, on August 9th. Less than a week afterward, August 14th, today, humanity's most terrible war was over. If there ever was a supreme pivotal moment in human history, that was it. All of the discoveries of science and their application to warfare culminated in the splitting of the atom and its use as an apocalyptic weapon of annihilation. Warfare might have stopped at that point with the realization that its ultimate potential would conceivably be the obliteration of civilization and probably the extinction of humanity. Instead, the war planners devised greater weapons of destruction while simultaneously continuing traditional warfare on a much smaller scale than the two world wars. A new word in the military lexicon, limited war, that presumably might be fought by client states, that's a quote, without reaching the irreversible point of oblivion. The world's most accomplished experts on the effects and consequences of nuclear weapons are the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As many as 140,000 died on the days of attack or immediately afterward, and the death toll rose by another 30,000 the next 5 years. Hundreds of thousands more were severely injured, many to never recover. Half a century later, people continue to die from wounds or illnesses traced to the effects of both bombs. A dozen years after the atomic bombs were used against human beings, Max Born wrote in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in June 1957, "Since the destruction of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, the atom has become a specter threatening us with annihilation." J. Robert Oppenheimer, who ran Los Alamos when it built the first atomic bomb, thought about the implications for mankind for the thing we had created, and the wall into the future we had breached. Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson might have had it right when he lamented, in Oppenheimer's recollection, quote, the appalling lack of conscience and compassion that the war had brought about, the complacency, the indifference, and the silence with which we greeted the mass bombings in Europe and, above all, Japan. Oppenheimer said that Stimson felt, as far as degradation went, we had had it, that it would take a new life and a new breath to heal the harm. Or as General Curtis LeMay, commander of the B-29's firebombing Japanese cities, put it, we knew we were going to kill a lot of women and kids when we roasted a town. Those firebombings were even used as a base mark for use of the atomic bomb. In the words of one government official, the number of people that would be killed by the bomb would not be greater than the number already killed in fire raids. Total death in total war. The two nuclear bombs that ended World War II, instead of putting an end to war, initiated a nuclear arms race between two conflicting and aggressive ideologies, the United States and Soviet Russia, allies and victors in the war against Nazism. Each developed huge stockpiles of nuclear weapons capable of obliterating the planet several times over. The result was a bipolar world maintained by a balance of terror defended by arguments that only nuclear parity could prevent a third world war. The USA and USSR spent hundreds of billions of dollars developing their nuclear arsenals, each government posing the threat of the other to continually escalate the race. The two superpowers raced through generations of nuclear weapons, blackmailing each other into increasing their arsenals and making treaties that allowed for more and deadlier weapons rather than their removal. And the contradictory idea of preventive wars, starting a war to prevent a war, was a common rationale for threatening world obliteration. Every small war anywhere in the world was a threat of nuclear confrontation. Simultaneously, these wars skirted oblivion by acting as pressure vents against the Big Bang. Within 40 years, the U.S. and USSR built up arsenals, which together contained more than 60,000 nuclear weapons. Soviet warheads alone numbered some 45,000 at their peak in 1986. By the end of the Cold War in 1991, with the collapse of the USSR, the awesome arsenal of nuclear devastation had been transferred out of human management to primarily technological control, primarily through computers and electronically controlled intercontinental ballistic missiles, ICBMs. A slippery, robotic grasp on the nuclear trigger. The mutual distrust and political paralysis that characterized the growth of the arms race spoiled chances for disarmament. Despite the insistent desire of the world's population to de-escalate nuclear terror, the arms race never slowed down until the internal collapse of the Soviet Union, much of it the result of exhausting its resources in the arms race. The use of nuclear energy was from the very beginning surrounded in secrecy. Only a handful, of course, knew what they were creating, Dwight MacDonald said after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It hardly needs to be stressed that there is something askew with a society in which vast numbers of citizens can be organized to create a horror like the bomb without ever knowing they are doing it. And that was Dwight MacDonald. The so-called national security state started with Hiroshima, Robert J. Lifton, and Greg Mitchell. Authors of Hiroshima in America, 50 Years of Denial, wrote in The Nation, a small group of relatively isolated leaders making drastic decisions and then concealing from the public the nature and consequences of their decisions. The American cover-up has been apocalyptic in at least two ways, they wrote, in the grotesque human dimension of what has been suppressed and in the relationship of that cover-up to our continuous embrace of still more destructive nuclear devices. Hiroshima, Lifton and Mitchell said, was the mother of all cover-ups, creating distortions, manipulative procedures, and patterns of concealment that have affected all of American life. Secrecy has been linked with national security and vice versa ever since. Nuclear alienation was the result of secrecy. Starting with Hiroshima, officials advised Americans to leave concerns about the bomb to political, scientific, and military experts, the nuclear priesthood. Americans were requested to opt out of the most critical issues of the age. Surrendering their right to know more about nuclear politics contributed to the gradual alienation from the political process. Despite the mass collusion in official secrecy and resentment at what had been concealed and falsified, Lifton and Mitchell asked, "To what extent do we feel ourselves a people who have been unforgivably deceived in the most fundamental of human areas, having to do with now, when, and by whose hand or lethal technology are we to die?" Instead of opening up to the world, the U.S. denied information about the bomb to the Russians, thereby guaranteeing a new nuclear arms race. The arms race began when the U.S. attempted to impress Russia with its military might so that it might be more manageable at the Potsdam Conference in May 1945, directly after the Nazi surrender, and withdraw its troops from Eastern Europe. Instead, the USSR began a crash program to develop nuclear capability, which it did 4 years later in 1949, at the same time enclosing what Winston Churchill dubbed an Iron Curtain around Eastern Europe. Once the United States began to rely on nuclear weapons to counter the perceived Soviet threat, the issues that kept the arms race going with the USSR were, as Carl Kaysen wrote, the profound ideological antipathy and demonization of the other side, the lag between the decision to build new weapons and their deployment, worst-case analyses, Soviet secrecy, and successful Soviet bluffs about the size and capability of their forces, and American belief in the possibility of sustaining technological superiority. That was Carl Kaysen. Beginning with Harry Truman, every Cold War president spoke of the necessity to achieve what Jimmy Carter and his successor Ronald Reagan called zero nuclear weapons. Yet under each administration, the arms race with the Soviet Union intensified until it seemed self-perpetuating and irreversible. Ironically, it was the U.S. that initially offered a blueprint for the abolition of nuclear weapons, suggesting the elimination from national armaments of atomic weapons and of all major weapons adaptable to mass destruction, quote, unquote. The U.S. plan was named after its representative to the United Nations Atomic Energy Council, Bernard Baruch, who said in 1946, "The search for the absolute weapon has reached fruition in this country, but she stands ready to proscribe and destroy this instrument, to lift its use from death to life, if the world will join in a pact to that end." Nations under the Baruch Plan would be barred from acquiring, developing, and possessing nuclear weapons, and all nuclear materials and production plants would be placed under international control. The Soviets countered with their own ban of nuclear weapons, but the icy chill of the impending Cold War polarized discussions until, in 1949, the Soviets test-exploded their first nuclear weapon. The Cold War did not completely freeze out the idea of eliminating nuclear weapons. In September 1961, the U.S. and USSR issued a joint statement agreeing to the elimination of all stockpiles of nuclear, chemical, bacteriological, and other weapons of mass destruction and cessation of the production of such weapons and the elimination of all means of delivery of mass destruction. And that's a quote. This effort, however, was a victim of the increased heating up of the Cold War, which culminated the following year when the Cuban Missile Crisis, the closest the world has so far come to nuclear war. Still the worst moment of the Cold War and perhaps of human history, which might have ended there, it is now said that our planet and species were not as close to obliteration as the participants thought, and a number of other brushes with nuclear oblivion followed, most publicly unknown, others from well-publicized systems failures. In particular, a few frightening instances of computer malfunctions averted breathtakingly close to the point of no return. A 13-cent part was at fault in one glitch, an interesting comment on the price of civilization. The Cuban crisis started when the U.S. discovered Russian nuclear missiles being emplaced on the island in late October 1962. The Russians claimed they thought the U.S. was about to invade Havana, which the U.S. denied, though the previous year it sponsored the Bay of Pigs fiasco and attempted several times to assassinate Fidel Castro. President John F. Kennedy and his advisors demanded the missiles be removed, and a naval blockade was set up to prevent Russian vessels from delivering any more of the weapons. In a very short time, the dispute reached for the doomsday button. The American myth is that the Soviet Union backed down from the brink of extinction and removed its missiles from Cuba. In reality, U.S. and Soviet political leaders cut an 11th-hour deal. The Soviets to withdraw their missiles from Cuba, the U.S. to remove some obsolete missiles from the Soviet border with Turkey. Because the military juggernauts of both countries were moving inexorably toward nuclear confrontation. At a time when the U.S. and USSR were settling into a Cold War status quo and recognizing a balance of terror that made it absurd to initiate a nuclear war because both would be obliterated, Communist China joined the nuclear club, which also included at the time England and France and probably Israel, to the consternation of the two primary superpowers. Perhaps more disconcerting, China accepted the discarded notion that nuclear war was not only inevitable but winnable. The arms treaties made during the Cold War were worthless in themselves, as are all treaties. After all, there is no court of accountability for nations short of war. Treaties exist only as long as they are convenient to their signers and have been used more often as justification for warfare than for peace. The importance of the nuclear arms treaties was not their ratification, but the process of negotiation, though ratification continued the process. Ironically, neither treaties nor the apprehensive secretness of the superpowers prevented international proliferation of nuclear technology. Secrecy removed public participation from the issue and made it a process by the very few, who in the United States manipulated pious mantras of patriotism and national defense as slogans for corporate profit and as a screen to obscure the immense fortunes fabricated from a war economy, fueled and made self-perpetuating with public money without much public say about it. Only now and then was an expense of corruption revealed and quickly hushed up. But the process itself was never examined for its devastating impoverishment of the social fabric seriously discussed. The mutual distrust and political paralysis that characterized the growth of the arms race spoiled chances for disarmament. Despite the insistent desire of the world's population to de-escalate nuclear terror, the arms race never slowed down until the internal collapse of the Soviet Union. The half-century nuclear arms race made the economies of both superpowers hostage to military spending. The American economy in particular produced an interlocking mafia of thousands of corporations involved in designing and constructing nuclear warheads and developing systems for transporting, arming, and launching the weapons. The estimated costs for maintaining as well as expanding the U.S. nuclear arsenal ranged into hundreds of millions of dollars annually, easily doubled when both nuclear and concomitant conventional military systems are considered. More millions of dollars should be factored in the form of nuclear weapons research grants to hundreds of universities and colleges. The nuclear arms race was a twofold liability to American society and assuredly Russian society as well. It held the citizens of both countries hostage to the fears and the oppressive secrecy it invoked, and it diverted hundreds of billions of dollars away from other social needs. The rubric of national defense not only built the private fortunes of munitions makers in the USA and placed them outside public scrutiny and accountability, it also gave them tremendous political power, which was generally conservative and anti-democratic in nature. The attempt to squelch public dissent during the Cold War dramatized the inseparable weave of business and military in peace and war. It also illuminated the charge that patriotism is a form of opportunity. Although U.S. school children conducted duck and cover drills throughout the Cold War, Americans were reluctant to teach their children about nuclear war while building ever more grotesque weapons. An example is an attempt by Oregon to establish a curriculum pertaining to nuclear war in the state's public elementary and high schools. The idea was to develop a program of the history of the nuclear age and the arms race that so quickly developed, the consequences of the use of nuclear weapons, and the effects upon national economies and ambitions, as well as alternate forms of resolving conflict short of war in general. The issue caused intense and heated debate. Supporters, mostly Democrats, said teaching children about nuclear war might be an important step toward averting Holocaust. Opponents, mostly Republicans, said it would create fear in children and weaken the nation's resolve to defend itself. Essentially, the people who didn't want kids to know about nuclear war were those whose policies encouraged it. One state representative, a Republican, compared nuclear education to sex education, which he said produced more pregnancies, abortions, and homosexuals than before it was taught. A 10-year-old girl wrote a letter to an Oregon newspaper at the height of the Cold War. She had just watched a movie about nuclear war, and she was afraid for her future. "I don't want war to happen," she wrote. "If a bomb does explode now, I think I'd rather die than live. Now when I think of my future, I think of nothing. I hope a war will never happen." International concern over skyrocketing nuclear arsenals finally prompted the United Nations to hold for the first time in 30 years a special session on disarmament in 1978. Signed by all UN members, the conference called on nuclear weapons nations to focus their efforts on the elimination of nuclear weapons. "Nuclear weapons pose the greatest danger to mankind and the survival of civilization. It is essential to halt and reverse the nuclear arms race in all its aspects in order to avert the danger of war involving nuclear weapons. The ultimate goal in this context is the complete elimination of nuclear weapons. The most effective guarantee against the danger of nuclear war and the use of nuclear weapons is nuclear disarmament and the complete elimination of nuclear weapons." Quote, unquote. The nuclear arms race quickened in the Reagan years. The U.S. readopted its formerly repudiated policy of arming for a winnable war. The balance of terror became a rapidly shifting teeter-totter during the early 1980s. Newer generations of horror were pokered like chips, including plans for a space-based ABM system in violation of the 1972 treaty that was quickly parodied as Star Wars. And psychologically, it seemed in the upper levels of government that denial matched the pace of reality. The more bizarre and dangerous the arms race got, so equally were official dismissals of the fears of Holocaust their actions precipitated. Though the Reagan policy was irresponsible and skirted oblivion, the renewed and more vigorous than ever arms race broke the Soviet Union, which was already fatally strained by internal contradictions and ruptures. Russian Premier Mikhail Gorbachev's remarkable personal appeal might have been a singular factor that put the brakes on the virtually out-of-control rush toward nuclear confrontation. Attempting to save his crumbling empire, Gorbachev tapped into the great worldwide angst about nuclear weapons in order to slow down the arms race, which was bankrupting the USSR. He paradoxically succeeded in terminating the Cold War, but was unable to stop Soviet communism from imploding. The abrupt end of the Cold War between the two superpowers and the shattering of the Soviet Empire that followed precipitated new dangers. The nuclear shift was no longer a big power confrontation, but was instead a different form of nuclear shadow hanging over the world that was not bound by the intricate series of treaties devised over a half century. With the Cold War over and the Soviet Union banished to history's dung heap along with the 20th century, it astonished and appalled. The United States, as the only remaining superpower, attempted to put in place a millennial form of Pax Americana by reinvigorating the high frontier Star Wars space satellite missile and laser system, which in theory might possibly be the ultimate nuclear menace, capable of raining laser beams and missiles down upon any place on the planet. Contrarily, it has been depicted as a sci-fi delusion that is, quote, extravagant, inept, unnecessary, and destabilizing. President George W. Bush, who once said the Cold War is over forever, seemed eager to impose nuclear superiority over the rest of the world. He unilaterally abrogated the 1972 ABM treaty and ratcheted up the development of so-called low-yield nuclear weapons while rolling back virtually every nuclear arms agreement made during the Cold War. The so-called Bush Doctrine's nuclear jingoism was basically that any other nation's nuclear arms were weapons of mass destruction, while the world-obliterating U.S. arsenal acted as a nuclear deterrent. This doublethink resonates throughout current American foreign policy, which is nothing less than regression to nuclear blackmail. Be damned if you possess or develop nuclear weapons. Be damned if you don't. Although the armistice of World War I lasted less than a generation, it was a hope that humanity's addiction to warfare might finally end because war had become too horrible to bear. Ironically, that hope accompanied the larger fears of nuclear annihilation during the Cold War, that a balance of terror made warfare itself obsolete. That balance, repulsive as it was, is yet regarded preferable to the post-Cold War uncertainty of wild-card nuclear expansion by nations or terrorists unrestrained by the possibility of collective oblivion. The development and use of atomic bombs on Japan will be disputed long after World War II diminishes to history as ancient as Caesar's campaigns in Gaul. The advent of the nuclear age might always be a topic of debate, although 1,000 years from now, the beginning of atomic power will be as misty as the discovery of fire or the first use of a hammer. The world has recently lurched away from the brink of nuclear war, yet its possibility is far from remote. Even now, a quarter century after the end of the Cold War and the ostensible cessation of the nuclear arms race and dismantling of the huge arsenals, it is an act of faith that at any instant deadly missiles might not have been launched from somewhere. On a normal day, we might all look up and see spiky umbrella-like contrails of nuclear missiles re-entering the atmosphere, and all that was normal a few moments before will vanish forever. Most people would rather not be reminded that they live in the age of plutonium, and that wherever they live, they are less than an hour away from a nuclear missile that has their address, despite post-Cold War reduction of WMDs. Enough remains to obliterate the planet multiple times. We cannot uninvent nuclear weapons. The knowledge of them is with us for as long as Homo sapiens defies its own handicaps and dwells in the galaxy. If we are not smart enough to contain our atomic goblin, our rubbled cities will leave little trace that we once briefly and foolishly ruled Earth. And that was something I wrote. The Mushrooms of August. And as I believe I gave a disclaimer, or maybe I didn't, that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in all of the multiple universes, but I truly hope not. And I have a trouble pronouncing nuclear clearly. I wish they'd have just kept it atomic. Much easier for my tongue to get around. Well, yesterday, August 13th, was International Left-Handedness Day. So I closed this program with something I wrote about it and dedicate it to all the world's lefties, which includes Julie, whom I wrote the poem about. I call it Children of Satan, and my disclaimer holds. August 13th is International Left-Handedness Day, which is sort of a sop to us left-wingers, like a rather smarmy apology to blacks for 3 centuries of slavery. Studies apparently demonstrate that 50% of babies not born with a right-handedness gene wind up lefties, which seems similar to humans not born with a certain chromosome doomed to be males. Most of our problems with being left-handed are political and cultural rather than intellectual or psychological, though these problems are societal in origin. I am left-handed, which is easier to be than in the past. Catholic nuns vigorously attempted to make me right-handed when I started school and accused me of being a son of Satan when I refused. I don't know why most people are right-handed. Because they are, the right hand is the hand of sustenance and labor, and the vile left hand began its evil reputation in ancient times when it was used to clean away the body's excrement. Thus, from antiquity has developed a sophisticated aversion to the left side of things. Prejudice against people who are left-handed predates more familiar bigotries of race, religion, nationality, gender, and homophobia. In every culture before record, all that is good and righteous has been accorded the right hand, while everything evil, ugly, wrong-headed, or simply clumsy, not to mention bad luck, is the left. In politics, as well as society, a crude bicameral cleft is made between right and left. The established order that resists change is the political and cultural right, which usually defends itself with tradition, religion, and autocratic power. The political left is the force of change and reform that calls upon the future instead of the past and explores new ideas and innovative social and political approaches to greater freedom and well-being of the common citizenry. Left is about justice, not privilege. The left is the opposition. Once in power, it automatically reverts to the right. Reform, resistance, and rebellion to contemporary rule in the United States has since at least the Russian Revolution been called by assaulted authority leftist, a sinister, from Latin sinus, meaning left or unlucky, hint at Bolshevik conspiracy, a suspicion of alien agents or homegrown dupes of foreign strategies to destroy the American way of life operating within its very heart. In other words, dissent and resistance to authority and or injustice in this land of liberty and justice is implied to be treachery. Perhaps because of ancient and immediate hostility toward left-handed people, we are usually supporters of underdogs and outcasts and feel personally sympathetic to ideals of personal and political liberty. Left-handed people share with women and minority races and religions, not to mention people with physical and mental handicaps, the problems of survival in a world designed with no consideration for their presence in it, or much worse, designed to eradicate their presence. And that was something I wrote, Children of Satan. And that's what the nuns compared me and some of the few other lefties in the class to. I claim that I have two very bad nightmares. One is Viet Cong with AKAs, and the worst one is nuns with rulers, which they cracked across my knuckles many times. And this has been Michael McCusker on this VJ Day 2014. I guess I'll see you next Thursday if certain things that do not happen to me, like a drone incinerating me on a sidewalk or falling into the river. And this is KMUN KTCB Astoria Killiniq 91.9 FM and 89.5 FM. Next up, NPR News Headlines.